When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
The support for the Labour government is quite broad but extremely shallow and fickle, because a lot of the support was, you're not the Tories. And then look at the popular vote. This Starmer government got fewer votes in the July 2024 general election than Corbyn got in 2019 and in 2017, when Labour had their worst election result for decades. The landslide was loveless.
Hello, welcome back to the Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill, and my special guest this week, Liam Halligan. Liam, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, Brendan. It's been a while.
It's been a while, and a lot has happened since we last spoke on this podcast. Not least that we've got a new government, the Labour government, and I guess I just want to start off with a broad question. I hope it's not a boring question, but in your capacity as a esteemed commentator on economic and political affairs for The Telegraph and many others, I wanted to ask you what you think of the new government. It seems to have had an extraordinarily short honeymoon period, even in comparison with other governments. It doesn't seem to be going fantastically well. What's your take on the Starmer government?
Well, I think the honeymoon was always going to be short, Brendan, because the landslide was loveless. We've got this headline majority of something like 170 seats. It's not quite clear what the majority is, because Labour has already suspended some of its MPs, of course. But, you know, a Blair-era majority, right? Blair got 179 in 1997, and Starmer got around 170 as a majority. But the underlying sophology of that result could not be more different. You know, I covered the Blair election for the FT as a lobby correspondent. There was a genuine wave of enthusiasm for New Labour. The shadow cabinet incoming, the new government, there were many people on those front benches who were already well known to the public and quite respected by the public, not just Brown and Blair, but people like Jack Straw, people like Alistair Darling, people like Mo Molam. Starmer has none of that. And then look at the popular vote. This Starmer government got fewer votes in the July 2024 general election than Corbyn got in 2019. And in 2017, when Labour had their worst election result for decades, Starmer got 32, 33% of the vote on a 60% turnout, which means 20% of the electorate backed Starmer and Labour. 4 out of 5 voters did not vote for Labour. So this is a loveless landslide. And I think Labour have made it worse for themselves by doing pretty knee-jerk things, which are alarming quite a few people who either didn't vote for them or even who did vote for them, like a very quick caving in to trade unions on public sector pay with no reforms on the side, signs of a lot of punitive taxation coming down the track on the 30th of October, things like reversing work that the Tories did to try and guarantee free speech on universities. That's really alarming. Even to some of the sort of bien pensant voters who did vote for Labour. Look, they have got a tough inheritance. They haven't got the 1997 inheritance, which Blair had, a sort of golden economic legacy, which Major's Tories government left them. I don't think the economy is a basket case. You know, growth is okay-ish by current standards across the G7 compared to the G7. Inflation is at or around target. unemployment is relatively low. The public finances are in a bad way. I think talk of this 22 billion hole that was, discovered, that's pure sophistry. Even the IFS, even the Institute of Fiscal Studies, says that gap in the public finances was, quote, there for anyone who dared to look. That's a direct quote from an IFS headline on their own website. So I do think Labour are over-egging the fiscal problems that they've discovered, but that doesn't mean that there aren't fiscal problems. There certainly are. But I think in general, the people on the front bench, the current government front bench, who I know and respect well, and there are several, there's some decent people there, but they need to think more about, their economics training. They need to think more about the practical and logistical realities of what they're trying to do, rather than going for the sort of pure ideological hit of wanting to do things because it's the right thing to do, even though it often isn't the right thing to do in the face of all evidence.
I want to come back to some of those things they're doing that you've just mentioned there, because I think they are worth interrogating. But just listening to you talk about the New Labour landslide of 97, I've been thinking along the same lines, because it's so interesting the differences between the Blair era and the new Starmer era. So Blair, as we know, came in on a wave of things can only get better. Starmer's motto seems to be things can only get worse. It has this really dispiriting, depressing feel to it, this government. But also, you're absolutely right that I had a million criticisms of the New Labour government. I thought they did some terrible things, and I'm not particularly a fan of Tony Blair. But you're right to say that when you look back at that era, you do realise now that there were some heavy-hitting politicians in that government, and one might even call them statesmen, people who could hold their own not only in Parliament but on the global stage, people who were quite serious and clearly quite focused. And that does seem to be lacking in the Starmer government. Certainly, if they're there, they're not being very public about it. So do you think there's a broader crisis of politics or a crisis of ideology? And I guess what you end up with after years and years of technocracy are these kinds of politicians that we have now who aren't really stirring and inspiring as politicians might have been in the past.
I think Labour is still thinking, even quite a few months in now, that they're in opposition rather than in government. I mean, crikey, Keir Starmer keeps calling Rishi Sunak the Prime Minister. But more than that, I mean, almost every answer to every difficult issue from a front bencher now is, somehow it's the Tories' fault. That isn't going to wash. Look, people got rid of the Tories in droves. Many, many Conservatives I know, and I'm sure you know, Brendan, didn't vote Conservative and or voted for Reform. Turnout was so low at such a pivotal moment in this 2024 election because an awful lot of Tories just stayed at home. And that's a big reason why the Conservative vote fell. But I think Labour needs to realise now that they are in government and they are responsible for making those tough decisions. And government is much, much harder than opposition. Look, a couple of weeks after the Labour landslide, I wrote in my Telegraph column that I thought the honeymoon could be short and it could even be a one-term government. And, various people got in touch on social media and privately to deride that point of view. But I don't think that for any party political reason. I just think that as an analyst, because I'm sensing the public mood and I'm looking at the underlying cephalogical realities of how popular Labour actually is. The support for this Labour government is quite broad, but extremely shallow and fickle, because a lot of the support was, you're not the Tories. The difference between Starmer's government, as it seems so far, and Blair's government is that when Blair's government got in, there were lots of slips and there were lots of mistakes and there were lots of things that were really egregious, as any government would offend thoughtful, attentive people in some way, shape or form. But Blair's and Brown, to his credit, they started to do stuff which at least kind of made sense. They brought in a minimum wage. You might not agree with it, but let's see how it goes. As it's turned out, that caused the Tories to reverse their policy on the minimum wage, and now that is rightly part of our institutional landscape. Blair and Brown in particular want to make the Bank of England independent. Let's see how it goes. They had actually a really well thought through windfall tax on the privatised utilities. Some of Labour's technocrats and bean counters had done a lot of work on that windfall tax in opposition, and everyone in the industry could see it was coming in, could see what it would mean. Labour's windfall tax on North Sea oil, it's just going to destroy the North Sea industry that employs tens of thousands of people. And it's just economically illiterate, because even the Climate Change Committee, the government's own in-house, you know, legally empowered conscience on climate policy, even the Climate Change Committee acknowledges that even if we get to net zero by 2050, you know, 30-odd% of our energy is still going to come from oil and gas. So the idea we can do without oil and gas, the idea we can tax the oil and gas industry into oblivion. And yeah, most of the oil and gas exploration in the North Sea net these days, it's not massive international multilateral, in quotes, fat cats. It's not the massive oil majors. It's small companies, often very heavily indebted, trying to get out little pockets of oil and gas here and there, much more difficult to bring to the service and use, but still economically viable, still strategically of enormous importance to this country. So, you know, let's just kill off the oil and gas industry. That's fine, because we're going to have a net zero grid by 2030. When even the grid people are saying, this is, you can't do this. It's too fast what you're doing. And that doesn't mean that it's not right to move towards renewable energy. Of course it is, but we need to solve the intermittency problems. We need to solve the storage problems, not just pluck a number or a year out of the air because it makes you look more virtuous in your political opposition and announce it. You know, announcements are not public policy. Announcements are announcements. They might get you a decent newspaper headline the next day, but far too much of what Labour is announcing, it strikes me, is naive and ideological, because they think that just by announcing something, it can happen. And it can't just happen, particularly on very, very technical areas of policy, which I know you study closely, Brendan, and I tried to keep up with, like climate policy, like housing, like taxation. And so I think Labour are showing themselves to be actually, you know, objectively, woefully underprepared for government, over ideological in government so far, and oblivious to the fact that 4/5 of the electorate didn't vote for them. Look, I'm probably like you. I'm a swing voter, right? I think it's outrageous that journalists align themselves with political parties. Oh, he's a Labour columnist and, you know, she's a Lib Dem columnist. I think that's mad. I think columnists should be swing voters, because we're the sort of supercharged swing voters, because we're swing voters that other swing voters might be interested in what we think, right? I've voted for all the parties over the years. I voted for Blair 3 times, so I'm not going to have anyone on the left say, oh, you're just a Tory. I mean, I'm an Irish Catholic, for God's sake. You know, I have very heterodox political views, a lot like you do, Brendan, you know, a lot like you. We are not slaves to any party or any tribe. We think through issues on a practical level, on a moral level, on a case-by-case basis. And there are a lot of people like me and you in the country, Brendan. And, you know, I think we need a really good Labour government, by the way. We need Labour to show that it can lead reasonably well without screwing up the economy unduly. And Blair achieved that. Brown to a lesser extent, but he was at least part of that. And that was good for our democracy because it kicked the Tories up the backside. But, you know, after 14 years in government, the Tories have become ridiculous, bloated, self-indulgent, lacking in all focus, fighting among themselves. We need a really good Labour government for a bit, if only to rebalance and reboot and renew our democracy, which is ultimately the most precious thing, in my view. I want Labour to do well, okay? And so what I'm saying is not because I've got grinding some party political axe. I'm not. It's what, you know, it's what I'm hearing from serious people in financial markets, you know, people managing big portfolios of gilts, you know, ringing me up sort of concerned, like, really? They really think they're going to make that money from raising capital gains tax? Do they actually understand anything about taxation? They really think they're going to make 1.7 million quid from slapping 20% on school fees for families struggling to send their kids to the school of their choice? There's a lot of analysis that comes out of the mouths of Labour ministers, which is demonstrably untrue, but fits a kind of ideological narrative that they're trying to pursue. That may work on, you know, a political chat show for a bit, particularly if the presenter is super excited to have a Labour government, which is often the case. But it's not going to work with financial markets. It's not going to work with investors. It's not going to work with the rest of the world. So I'd like to see a lot more reality, a lot more practicality from this new Labour government. And actually, I think Britain needs Labour to succeed, at least at a certain level. So I'm not wishing them ill. I'm not trying to pull this government down in any way. I'm trying to give them some honest and open advice from a swing voter.
If you're a regular listener to this show or a regular reader of Spiked, why not become a Spiked supporter? Spiked supporters is our thriving community of people who donate to Spiked. Anyone who gives £5 or more a month or £50 or more a year can become a Spiked supporter and get access to lots of exciting perks. Spiked supporters can comment on articles, get free and discounted tickets to events, get a discount on all items in our shop, and bookmark articles as you browse. This is our way of saying thank you to all of you who fund our work. Spiked is completely free, and yet you still hand over your hard-earned cash to make sure that anyone, anywhere can read us and listen to us. We're incredibly grateful for your generosity. If you don't give to Spiked yet, now is the perfect time to start. Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to set up your donation and your Spiked supporters account. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the curses in contemporary politics is tribalism and, you know, the unwillingness of certain groups of people to say anything positive about the Conservatives because they're evil Tory scum, or anything positive about Labour because they're crazy left-wing communists, or however they're caricatured. You know, the approach ought to be, surely, especially for those of us who haven't tied our flag to any party in particular, the approach should be that we want the government to do well by the people of the country. And I think on that question, I did want to ask you a little bit along those lines of you making these criticisms because you want the government to do well. I did want to ask you about a few of their economic policies that they've already announced or will be pursuing, which you described recently in one of your Telegraph columns as being ideological, as being motivated more by a determination to signal their virtue to their fellow travellers in the political universe rather than to do well by the nation. And there's a couple of examples you gave. You just mentioned some there. But I did want to ask you about the VAT on private school fees, because that to me is such a good example of a policy that is ill thought through and which is clearly done to titillate the middle classes. It's usually the middle classes who are most obsessed with private schools. This is not an issue that keeps working class people up at night, by the way. It's usually the kind of middle classes who are obsessed with the supposed evils and inequality of private schools. So Labour will get some brownie points
often
from
having been to private schools themselves.
Exactly, yeah, they're the most vocal. So Labour might get some brownie points from those people, but they're not going to raise much money with this VAT on school fees. Is that really what's driving them? Just that determination to reprimand what they've view as the stuffy upper classes? Is that really what's going on here?
Yeah, I do think it's performative. It's certainly not going to raise much money, if any money at all. I also think it's the way it's been brought in has been beyond ideological. I think it's actually got nasty, the way the date was dragged forward to January 2025 rather than September 2025, which ministers had assured the independent sector it would be. So the change was brought in the middle of the school year, in the middle of school summer holidays. So head teachers and finance offices were scrambling around and holidays were being cancelled. Parents were being unduly scared, having been told one thing by their school, which the government had told the school and everyone else, and then the government changes its mind. Look, I've got skin in this game in that I'm an independent school governor, right? And I'm the governor of the school that I went to, which you know the school because we grew up roughly in the same neck of the woods. I got a scholarship to that school. I got an academic scholarship to that school. It's the only school exam that I did. And I did it because a neighbour told my mum that the school offers scholarships and maybe I should go for one. A neighbour who had helped me to read books because there were no books in my house, right? And that school changed my life. I left as head boy. They asked me to be a governor. Of course, I'm going to be a governor. But nothing I say now reflects that school, its position, internal discussions we've had. What I'm about to say now, I say as just, you know, an economic commentator, albeit one who was lucky enough to have an independent education on a full scholarship. The exodus from independent schools is going to be much bigger than the government thinks. And the reason is that most people who send their kids to independent school are not sending them to, you know, the grand schools, the Eatons, the Winchesters, the Rugbys, the Harrows, and all the rest of it. Most people's experience of independent education is a local school that might previously been a grammar school, offering a kind of grammar school style education, or special needs school, or a specialised school, like in dance or music or something like that. Most experience of independent education isn't, you know, 50 grand a year for full boarding and all the bells and whistles, and these parents are paying their school fees out of compound interest. Most people paying school fees are double income households, families striving, paying school fees out of income, not out of wealth, out of taxed income, not because they've got some trust fund somewhere. That's a complete caricature of the independent school sector. Of course, there are incredibly grand schools, and they will be fine. They will find a way to absorb this, and their parents will find a way to absorb this. But for an awful lot of people in this country, an awful lot of, you know, small C conservatives, you know, maybe swing voters, professional families, maybe first generation professional families, first generation users of independent education, it will have been the aspiration of those parents, many of whom are immigrant families, by the way, a generation or two here, certainly in the part of London where we come from, Brendan. They are striving, striving, striving. The schools they send their kids to are not incredibly gilded institutions with huge endowments. They're schools running tiny surpluses, if any surpluses, and 80, 90% of their cost base is staff, right? So the idea they can just absorb 20% and not have to increase fees to parents, as Labour have been intimating, it's completely wrong and economically illiterate, and shows no understanding at all of how you run a business and how you run a business with very, very high portion staff costs and high overheads. So, you know, you make the surplus on the marginal, you know, the last sort of 10 or 20 kids who are in the school, right? That's where you make a surplus that allows you to reinvest and to pay down debts, and so you don't go bankrupt as a charity, by the way. And to do this, school fees have increased a bit, you know, incrementally, but to do this in a massive one-off hit, parents are really scared about this. They're sitting in kitchen tables around the country with their spreadsheets saying, I can't get any more overtime. We can't do this. We're going to have to pull the kid out of the school. And Labour are thinking it's going to be a very small number. It's going to be quite a significant number. A lot of independent schools, unfortunately, are going to close down. Often independent schools, which are hugely important in their local communities, providing all kinds of jobs, all kinds of outreach, all kinds of collaboration with local schools. And those, you know, lesser, if you like, independent schools, not the grand schools, Tom Brown school days, those lesser independent schools, they are massive engines of social mobility in this country. And I should know, because I went to one, albeit I went to one on a scholarship. And they're engines of social mobility because hardworking parents, first generation users of independent schools, can secure an education that they don't think the state sector can provide. And in some cases and in some localities, they're right. The state sector isn't providing a good education. In some places it is. You know, I live in a town now outside of London, and the comprehensive school, the state school in this town is second to none. It's absolutely fantastic. So this isn't an ideological thing. It's just to acknowledge that education is an ecosystem. And what Labour's policy will do, and I do think it's a spiteful policy, it's probably going to cost the Exchequer money by the time the state has absorbed many, many kids from the independent sector whose parents are totally spooked by a big fee increase, which of course applies every single year their kid are in the school. And they've probably got two or maybe three kids. So this is absolutely huge. Even if the school's managed to absorb some of it. But they need to acknowledge that education is an ecosystem. They need to acknowledge that most people using independent education are striving swing voters. They are not, you know, landed shire Tories who have been sending their offspring to the same school for generations. And also, schools themselves do such a huge amount of work providing bursaries, scholarships, community outreach. And when your balance sheet is squeezed, Brendan, they're the first things to go.
It's so true what you say. You know, the people I know who send their kids to private schools, all of them, every one of them that I know personally, comes from a working class background, has done well for themselves, and wants to, over the course of one generation, push their family up a really high level in the social system. That's what it is. That's, you know, these are people who work incredibly hard, who struggle to pay the fees already, and the idea of them being bumped up quite suddenly is going to be a shock to the system for a lot of these kinds of people. But there's this kind of, amongst some in labour, on the periphery of labour as well, there is this desire constantly, it seems, for almost like a phony class war. They have this caricature of everyone at private school is a top hat wearing toff kid, you know, whose name is Seventus or something. You know, they just have this ridiculous view of what these people are like because it satisfies their desire to pose as great class warriors who are fighting against, you know, the upper classes and bringing equality in, and they're often doing the opposite of that. And along those lines, I did also want to touch on the question of another economic issue, which is capital gains tax and the sharp rises Labour is proposing in relation to that. You wrote about that recently as well, and that does seem to be another instance where the gains from it might not be very big at all, and in fact there might be blowback from such a policy, but again it seems to be driven by that desire to appear virtuously anti-fat cat. So again, it seems to be a policy that is about satisfying certain Labour voters rather than thinking seriously about whether this will help with the economic situation. So give us your take on the capital gains tax issue. What's going on there? What's, are there going to be any benefits from this? What are they likely to be?
Well, I think, again, it's an ideological tax. Even HMRC has said that a 10 percentage point increase in the high rate of capital gains tax would actually lose the Exchequer a couple of billion pounds a year as investors radically change their behaviour to avoid the higher levy. It's been criticised, that policy, by, you know, none other than Nick McPherson, who used to be the Treasury Perm Sec. You know, no friend of the Tories he, but a very bright man. The killer point is that raising the rate of capital gains tax just does not bring you any revenue. When you increase the rate, people just sit on the gains and wait for a government to come along which will have a lower rate, says Nick McPherson. You can nudge capital gains up gradually over a period of time, but to come into office all guns blazing, sharp shooting, we're going to raise capital gains tax on all those corporate fat cats. Well, all the corporate fat cats are much, much, much cleverer than anyone in politics and Whitehall, right? However much you don't like them, and they'll just shapeshift and legally do stuff, even if they just don't sell stuff, in order to not pay the higher rates. And who will be caught by this? I tell you who will be caught by this, Brendan. It's those same lower and middle income strivers, the alarm clock classes, the people where mum and dad are working their backsides off so their kids can have stuff that they didn't have. And you can sniff at that if you're a certain kind of voter. But it's that animus, it's that dynamic, it's that instinct that drives pretty much all human progress. The desire of people in families to do the right thing by the people who they love. And it's same with capital gains tax. Who's going to be caught by it? Not the corporate fat cats. Not, you know, sophisticated individuals with back offices and lawyers and accountants on speed dial. It's going to be, you know, the kind of family that you or I came from, Brendan, a family that's worked really hard from nothing, built up some modicum of financial security somehow, and you could see 20 years ago pensions were a crock, pension schemes falling over all over the place, and so they invested their money in a buy-to-let, a single buy-to-let, something like that. Maybe two. It's those kind of people that are going to get done in by this when they go to sell their investment in order to annuitize it and make a pension for themselves, give some of the gains to their kids so their kids have at least some hope of getting on the housing ladder within 50 miles of their parents if they live in a city. And these are the people, again, who are going to be stung by this. It's not the corporate fat cats. Just as when I go, you know, when I'm sorry, any questions the other day, and I was saying about the public sector pay rise. I want public sector workers to be paid properly, but they are only a fifth of the workforce and they already have much better working conditions in the main than private sector workers, longer holidays, sick pay, public sector pensions, of course. And the thing that came back at me from another panelist was, what about all those private sector fat cats in the city with their bonuses, right? All right, so that's like 0.25% of private sector workers. What about all the people, you know, doing five cleaning jobs? What about all the people working in the private sector who aren't in financial services? And indeed, by the way, some people in financial services aren't particularly well paid. Though, of course, the press focuses on the grotesque excesses of some of those who are. So there's so much oversimplification of politics and policy. Labour have been simplifying issues to the point that where they've become simplistic, an oversimplification that tips a description of a situation beyond disingenuous to actually a misrepresentation and a blatant misrepresentation. So to raise capital gains tax so fast, so early, is just going to be a red rag to a bull. It won't raise much money. It could even cost the government money. Again, as the HMRC itself and a former Treasury Permanent Secretary has said, and it won't be, you know, the big corporations that get caught on this. It will be ordinary men and women who have strived really hard to carve themselves and their families out just a little bit of capital, just a little bit of freedom, just a little bit of money so they can have a dignified retirement after making the country work for the last 30 or 40 years. And that is politically inept of Labour, because they are the swing voters who will decide the next election.
You know, for a government to not think through the consequences of its policies or the consequences of its actions, I think that's always when a government loses me, because if you aren't capable of thinking through what the impact of these economic measures will be, then, you know, why should I take you seriously as a government?
And again, it's not a left-right thing, Brendan. You know, Margaret Thatcher did exactly the same. It was just hubris. It was just such a sense of self-entitlement and empowerment that we are going to do the poll tax and it's a good idea, even when it was clearly a mad idea. It was deeply regressive. It was disproportionately punitive on the poor at the time when, you know, the economy was pretty tough for a lot of people lower down the income spectrum. And she was drummed out of government because of it, and probably rightly so. So it's not just the left who have these kind of flights of ideological fantasy. It's the right as well. But I do think the left have something particular to them that's very, very unattractive. They think they have a monopoly on wisdom. They think that anybody, say like me, who is raising difficult technical issues, if you don't instantly agree with them and instantly go along with them with what they're saying, without any question, fuss or mannerism, then you're evil. You're nasty. You're morally suspect. And that's crazy. And that is an environment for very, very, very bad decision-making and very, very, very bad public policy. And that's the fear I have. Labour are in such a kind of ideological bubble now that they are starting to move towards making some pretty weird and, I would say, objectively damaging decisions for this country. And I say that with regret, Brendan. Again, I say that with regret because I want this Labour government to succeed. I want it to do well because I care a lot more about our country than I do about any particular person or any particular political party. It's like the gratitude of immigrants, isn't it? Which I think you and I have in some ways. And I think that a really good period of office from Labour and then a fair fight with the Tories, a rejuvenated Tory party, is the best possible outcome for our country. So I want Labour to succeed. And that's why I'm saying the things that I'm saying, even though I know I'm going to be personally attacked and derided for what I'm trying to do.
You know, one area where I want this government to succeed, and or any government, whatever a government it was, I want them to succeed in the area of house building, because this is something you've written about a lot. This is something that is front and center of so many political discussions, as it should be, because the decline in house building has been extraordinary. You had some remarkable statistics in one of your recent Telegraph columns about, I think, in the 50s, 60s and 70s, we built around 3 million homes per decade, and now it's gone down to around 1.1 million homes per decade, which is just astonishing and awful, and it's had so many terrible consequences. As you pointed out in your column, one of the key reasons that 18 to 34 year olds at the moment are the least likely generation since the 30s to get on the housing ladder is because we don't have new houses, or we certainly don't have the number of new houses we need. So again, in the spirit of wanting the government to do something good for the country, you have raised the critical point that you're not convinced that what they're saying on housing is going to address the housing crisis. So how do you see that playing out under Labour?
It's a really complex area, Brendan, and I obviously out laid out a lot of housing policies in my book, Home Truths, which came out in 2021 in paperback anyway. And, you know, I've had very, very long conversations at their request with Tory and Labour front benchers who have read the book closely. That I agree with Labour very much that there are parts of the Greenbelt we need to build on. The Greenbelt is 13% of the landmass of this country. Residential housing, including gardens, is less than 2%. Of course, there are parts of the Greenbelt that are aesthetically very beautiful. I think the worst kind of building on the Greenbelt is when you stick a load of new builds on the edge of a village in a rural situation. That's just designed to just wind everyone up. We should be building on parts of the Greenbelt that are urban scrub. We should be building on parts of the Greenbelt that are near newly built railway stations. I'm thinking of Crossrail. No one's talking about concreting over the countryside, okay? When, as I say, 13% of this country is Greenbelt, and the Greenbelt is now more than twice as big in acreage, Brendan, as it was in the late 70s, because councils, particularly Lib Dem councils, by the way, keep adding to it all the time. We are not concreting over the country, yeah? Less than 2% of this country is housing. But we need to house our people. And I would be building more around existing new towns, sprucing up those new towns. New towns often have pretty good communications links. They're often near other towns and cities where there is a lot of employment. They're often big enough to generate employment themselves. I would be doing that. I wouldn't be taking swathes of the open countryside or building around villages. That's just a NIMBY's charter. And NIMBYism isn't always irrational. I mean, and so we have to work with the grain of human nature. And they're some of the policies I outlined in Home Truths. Look, briefly, the first thing I'd do straight away, and how many one-page memos have I given how many housing secretaries on this? Many, right? A one-pager I've done several times is the state owns 6% of all freehold land in this country. The Treasury is dogmatically opposed to selling any of that land because they always think, oh, we could get more for it later. That's moronic. Sell some of the land, having prepared the land for house building, the state can do that, attaching utilities there, sell the plots off, the service plots, and earmark them for local small builders. You can tackle the huge oligopoly, which is our house building industry, a cartel in many ways, a group of localized cartels. They would deny that, though plenty of leading politicians have used that word, which I used first in Home Truths, because there is an awful lot of restrictive practice going on. There is a lot of drip feeding the market. There is a lot of land banking, and Home Truths proves it, even though the house builders deny it. So I would get state land. I would provide the utilities there, and I would allow small builders to build homes quickly on those plots, competing on quality and on price. That will give small builders a chance to get hold of land at a relatively economical cost. At the moment, 70% of the value of any new home, of any home, is the land, right? It was 5% in the 50s. And the reasons are very, very complicated, but it all comes down to the 1961 Land Compensation Act. And look, very, very briefly, because this isn't a podcast about housing policy, I put forward a policy where when agricultural land is granted planning permission, the planning uplift, the value of the land, can often go up 200 or 300 times, right? That is called planning uplift. That planning uplift, under the current legislation, all goes to the landowner, and or a big chunk of it often goes to shadowy land agents who have had options agreements with the landowner for many years, often over generations, completely unregulated, completely unknown. We don't know who controls a lot of the land in our country, by the way. I don't want all that uplift to go to the landowner. I think that some of that uplift should be shared with the local authority, not the Treasury, the local authority. I say half the planning uplift should go to the local authority. And then that value can be used by the local authority as houses are being built, to build schools and hospitals at the same time, to make development go hand in hand with that local infrastructure which people need. NIMBYs rightly say there's nothing in this house building for me. It's going to be noisy, it's going to be troublesome, and then it's going to be even harder to get a doctor's appointment, even harder to get, you know, a kid into a good local state school or whatever it is. Even more traffic, right? But if you use that land value uplift at the point that it happens, You can borrow against it. There's all kinds of mechanisms that you can use. This mechanism is used in many, many other countries in the world. Australia, Germany, you know, Hong Kong was built on shared land value uplift. The Netherlands, parts of America, Australia. We're an outlier. We've got this feudal system where the whole of the uplift goes to the landowner, and that is then reflected in the price of the land, which house builders buy. So another reason why houses are so expensive and new builds are often so crappy. Small, pokey, low spec, often without fire safety, insulation, and so on. All these things I've proven on various, you know, documentaries over the years, because the developers are paying so much for the land, because the fact that all the uplift goes to the landowner pushes up the price of land and you get a speculative bubble emerging. If we shared the planning game, then local authorities could build the infrastructure as the houses are being built, and the local discussion about whether or not they want development will be revolutionized, Brendan, because then you get a lot of people, particularly younger people, saying, well, we fancy a new school, we fancy a new hospital, we fancy a bypass to save the center of our village. And we can do all these things with the shared spoils of the planning uplift, rather than it all going, you know, to landowners, often in offshore trusts, right? This is basic economics. Labour, instead of going for my completely moderate version of this, which is a 50-50 split, a version that's been endorsed, by the way, by some of Britain's leading housing academics, yeah? Even though some idiot journalist has come up with them, the plans that have been endorsed by, you know, Sajid Javid backed these plans. Sajid Javid tried to put these plans through Parliament, my plans, and Downing Street stopped him for all kinds of reasons. But Labour are going to the other extreme. Labour want to take, instead of the whole of the planning uplift going to the landowner, ideologically, again, they want the whole of the planning uplift to go to the state. That means that landowner is going to be a legal quagmire. You're going to literally, ironically, Starmer must be too dense to understand this, you're going to have landowners using the ECHR to stymie Labour's policy on taking all the land value uplift. The very ECHR that Keir Starmer says Britain will always stay in as long as he's the Prime Minister. But it's just going to be a legal monstrosity, endless CPOs, because the only way you're going to get land off any landowner is CPO it off them, compulsory purchase order, because they'll think this is so mad, the Tories are going to reverse it. And there's a whole history of this throughout the 50s and 60s of this policy flip-flopping between Labour and the Tories. And it's all outlined in Chapter 8 of Home Truths, if anyone wants to read it. And yet Labour, despite huge effort by some of us to convince them of the right way to do this, right in the sense that it's practically doable and could be done relatively quickly and is sustainable politically because it's a compromise, they've gone for the full fat ideological version, which will kill off the idea of using land value uplift, which is a brilliant idea used around the world. We're an outlier for not using it. It will kill it off for another generation.
Hi, it's Brendan here. I just wanted to remind you that you can still buy my book. It's called A Heretic's Manifesto, Essays on the Unsayable. And I've really been blown away by the response to it from readers, reviewers, Spike supporters. People really like this book, and I think you're going to like it too. It covers all the insanities of our time, from climate change hysteria through to COVID authoritarianism, through to the trans ideology. And it basically makes the case for more freedom of speech, more debate, and more heretical thinking to challenge the conformism of our times. So what are you waiting for? Go to Amazon right now and order my book, A Heretic's Manifesto, Essays on the Unsayable. And now on with the show.
I mean, those policies sound perfectly sensible to me, and I'm sure they do to many other people, including the people who've read your book as well. When I think about housing and other issues to do with infrastructure, I often wonder if the problem is even broader than we think. So, you know, there are all the problems to do with the house building crisis that you've talked about at length. You know, there's the red tape, there's the avaricious state that wants all the benefits for itself. There are so many reasons that the millions of new homes we need are not being built. But do you think there's a broader messing up priorities across government? So you mentioned earlier on the net zero ideology and the creation of a date out of thin air to transform Britain's economy so it produces zero carbon emissions and moves much more faster towards renewables. Now, you say that that might be a good idea. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but there's a bigger problem here, isn't there, where when the nation's priorities become fast-tracking towards being this carbon-meek country that doesn't do too many things that might pollute or might rip up the countryside or might lay down too much tarmac or whatever else it is, then when that becomes the priority, other things do inevitably get left by the wayside. And that, at some level, will include house building, but it might also be digging for more oil and gas in the North Sea. It might be other areas of economic and manufacturing life that could be very beneficial to the nation. So is there a broader problem with the green obsession that actually has a detrimental impact on our ability to move forward as a country?
I think it's become totemic and a statement of one's morality to go along with any new targets that are plucked out of the air. And the targets are just plucked out of the air in a sort of party political parlour game. The Tories want 2035 to ban sales of new petrol and diesel, so Starmer's going to take it back to 2030 just so he looks cool. But the actual practical realities and logistics of achieving that are completely secondary to the headline hit and how it focus groups. And this isn't leadership. This is student politics, right? This is not leadership. And let's just think about that ban on new petrol and diesel cars. Now, look, I have to say this. I want more renewable energy, right? I want more renewable energy. If we can use more renewable energy in a way that doesn't break the bank and actually benefits less well-off people in our country who disproportionately pay for energy, it's a bigger share of their disposable income. So they are getting mullered by this because so many of the subsidies are going on consumers' bills, the subsidies to renewables. That is a problem. You know, renewables are not cheap when we've got the most expensive electricity for end users in Europe, and we've got a very high share of renewables. And unless all this virtue signalling leads to cheaper bills for ordinary people and for companies to regain our competitiveness, then support for net zero is going to completely dissolve and go the other way. It's the same when it comes to the idea that we can decarbonise our grid by 2030. That means that there's no carbon used in electricity generation at all. So it's all nuclear, all renewable, all biomass. So in other words, no even gas-fired power stations, which are currently, depends on the day, between 20 and 40% of what we use. And vitally, the gas-fired power is there to solve the intermittency problem, which is inherent in renewables. And that sounds like a load of gobbledygook, right? But what it means, unless you've got gas-fired power stations, you're going to have blackouts. And that is not an irresponsible thing to say. You know, I'm quoting very serious people. I'm reflecting what very serious people who frankly need to speak up more are telling me off the record. You know, it is time for people in the public sector with their public sector pensions, their nice, cozy public sector jobs, to start speaking truth about some of these issues on behalf of the public and going public if they need to make ministers listen. The idea that you can just ban new petrol and diesel cars from 2030, you've now got people in the car industry speaking up about this. You are going to hand our entire car market to China, which is making massively state-subsidised EVs at a huge rate of knots. EVs that at the moment no one wants to buy because the technology isn't really there yet, unless you can afford a very, very, very expensive one, and the charging network isn't really there yet. And frankly, a lot of people in the car industry are thinking to themselves, why, understanding that renewable generates lots of subsidies, they're thinking to themselves, are EVs really the way to go? Is this a blind alley? Yeah, let's get off petrol and diesel, but are there other ways to do this? So just to bring in 2030, when the national grid can't store any of the excess energy that renewables sometimes inevitably deliver, and they can't fill the holes, the gaps which renewables inevitably cause without gas-fired power stations. Just to say, because it goes down well in a dinner party in certain parts of North London, not the parts of North London where we grew up, Brendan, that I'm going to do 2030 because I'm a real man and I really care. What about the engineering reality of that? What about the fact we've got the lowest gas storage per head of any major economy in the world? What about the fact that hundreds of thousands of people work in our oil and gas industry? Over a million people work in our car industry. The virtue signaling headline seems more important than all that. And Labour are going to have a real problem with a lot of their trade union friends over this. What the GMB have been saying about Labour's net zero plans, the GMB who have lots of, you know, very, very highly skilled, brave offshore oil workers and people working in the energy complex as a whole. Reality is going to bite for these guys, and it would look a lot better for them, and it would be much better for the country. It would look as if they looked as if they actually understood what that reality was and acted as such before it hits them smack in the face.
You know, when I see even radical leftists, never mind the Labour government, but when I see radical leftists on the streets demanding net zero right now, you know, shut down oil, shut down gas, I just think, how did you end up in a situation where you're effectively campaigning for the end of good jobs for working class people? You know, there are lots of people who work in these industries and who make a nice wage and who get a lot of sense of self-respect and autonomy from the work they do. And the idea that you could just scrub all that away in the name of some future dream of a virtuous land that's free of carbon is such a fantasy. And it really is a good example of where virtue signaling actually becomes dangerous and has reckless consequences.
There's just such ignorance. Politicians talk endlessly about our energy mix, but they only talk about the energy mix in terms of our electricity generation. I know this because I talk to them privately and it's clear they don't know what they're talking about. Oh, but, you know, 40% of our energy is renewables now. No, on some days, 40% of the electricity we generate comes from renewables. How about transport? How about, you know, the use of hydrocarbons in petrochemicals and manufacturing processes? You know, something like 70% of the energy that we use, Brendan, in this country, when you get beyond electricity as a whole, is oil and gas. Even the Climate Change Commission, on incredibly Panglossian assumptions, optimistic assumptions about how great renewables are going to be and how we're going to solve all the intermittency and the storage problems overnight, because Ed Miliband says we must. Even the Climate Change Commission acknowledges that by 2030, if we hit our targets, 50% of our energy is going to be oil and gas. And by 2050, when we're going to be at net zero, those sunlit uplands, still 25 to 30% of our energy is going to be oil and gas. That is the Climate Change Commission, who most independent analysts think are out to lunch when it comes to the actual reality of what is going to happen. But let's take their incredibly rose-tinted assumptions as read, obviously assumptions which give the best possible performance to renewables, because that's, you know, that's how these guys roll. Even then, still 25 to 30% of our energy is oil and gas. So let's use our own. Let's keep the jobs in the UK. Let's keep the union together, because otherwise Scottish politics is going to go ballistic if Aberdeen loses, the oil and gas capital of Europe, by the way, loses all those great jobs. And some of them will go to renewables, of course. Some of them will go to manufacturing turbines for offshore rather than servicing oil rigs. You know, I've been up to Aberdeen several times. I've made films up there about whether or not the oil and gas complex can transition to renewable. And of course there's some kind of natural transition there, but not just because Ed Miliband says so, it must all be done by 2030. It's just so naive. It just gives all the power in this to the providers, so they just suck up ever more government subsidies. The renewable companies have got the government over a barrel because the government's now committed to this target. And the renewables say, oh, we couldn't do it for less than this, and less than this. Yeah, they're not bidding at auctions where they're getting guaranteed prices for their power, because they know a desperate government will have to up the price even more. And all those subsidies, Brendan, whisper it, go on the bills of ordinary people and ordinary companies. And ordinary people, it's regressive when you tax energy in this way, even if it's for a very nice cuddly thing like renewables, because the poor pay disproportionately more for their energy as they do for their food. Inflation in general hits the poor hardest, energy and foodflation particularly so.
You know, it really has become a theme of our times that, you know, all these supposedly great, grand, virtuous policies that are being pursued tend to hit the poorest in society the hardest. A couple of other issues I wanted to ask you about, Liam, before I let you go. The first is the future of the Conservative Party. So we've talked a lot about Labour. You've said that you're a swing voter. You voted for Labour. You voted for Conservative. So I'd very interested to get your take on where you think the Tories might go next. You did one of the, I think you did the first interview with Kemi Badenoch, who's one of the favourites in the contest to be the leader of the Conservative Party. There are others in there as well, of course. I think you said earlier that one of the good things, if Labour starts doing well or starts pursuing half-decent policies that win the support of the public, one of the beneficial offshoots of that is it might compel the Tory party to up their game and to get their act together. You're absolutely right. At the end of 14 years of Tory government, this was a bloated, ridiculous party. It had no vision. It had no capacity to enact whatever policies it really wanted to enact. It really was an exhausted carcass of a government. So this party does need to sort itself out. What do you think are the prospects for that happening? How do you see the Conservatives panning out over the next couple of years?
Well, firstly, Brendan, I think the contest is taking far too long. We're not due to have a leader of the opposition until early November. That's a full 4 months after Labour won the general election. Rishi Sunak is sort of around when he's not with the tech bros in LA, and he's a capable dispatch box performer. But, you know, he's a lame duck leader and his heart isn't really in it, with all respect to him. So the Tories desperately need a leader of the opposition. The country desperately needs a leader of the opposition. The fact that we won't have a leader of the opposition at the time of the 30th of October budget, which is, you know, gearing up to be a pretty historically pivotal budget, is really a bad look, not least because the leader of the opposition traditionally responds to the budget, right? So I think that is a huge mistake. The Tories have got a choice, and there's obviously a battle going on within the Tory party, as there always and inevitably is. You know, the reason the Tory party has spent more time in government than any other party in this country's history, the reason the Tory party, for all its massive failings, is on that basis probably the most successful political party in the history of man in any kind of democracy. The amount of time they've spent in government compared to the amount of time they've not spent in government, you know, particularly actually since universal suffrage came into this country in the late 20s. They've been a formidable electoral force, and that's because they're a very broad church and they take in a whole range of opinions. So there are always going to be fights. So it's just about how they conduct those fights and how quickly they're resolved. Obviously, there's a fight between the One Nation Tory Reform Group, sort of left Tories, and the more centre-right Tories, Suella Braverman and beyond, the kind of Tories who might jump to reform at some stage. The question is, do they need a One Nation leader now, or do they need a more centre-right leader now? Obviously, it's a political truism. You hear it endlessly trotted out by people who've never really thought about it, or maybe thought about it in the 90s and then stopped thinking about it. UK elections are won on the centre ground, and they are won on the centre ground. The question is, where is the centre ground? Is Starmer on the centre ground? Do the Tories need a kind of TRG, Tweedy, nice Tory from the Shires who just fought off the Lib Dems to compete with Starmer on the centre ground? Or do they need a centre-right candidate who can look Farage in the eye and what is best for their electoral chances? I would say this, and I said exactly this, Brendan, on the latest episode of Planet Normal, my podcast, which I co-present with Alison Pearson, as you know, and I think it's right. I'll try it out on you. So the centre ground, according to sort of the political and media class, i.e. Starmer, is not the centre ground where the country is. The centre ground where the country is way to the right of that kind of bubble centre ground, that kind of beltway, Westminster-centric centre ground. And what's my proof for that? My proof for that is that Starmer, in his kind of, you know, herbivorous positioning, got 20% of the vote, right? 20% of the electorate, 33% of a very low 60% turnout. Actually, the real centre ground, and I think there's a huge silent tribe of people waiting for a Tory leader who can take them onto this ground, is centre-right. It is more concerned about immigration than Labour is. It is more concerned about fiscal incontinence than Labour is. It is more concerned about high taxation than Labour is. You know, it's the kind of people who we grew up with, Brendan, really hard-working people who aren't dogmatic or party political in any way. They just want their politicians to stop doing really stupid things that make it impossible or even harder for them to provide to the best of their ability for themselves and their family. And for that reason, I think it would be a mistake. I think they need somebody more on the centre-right. I think that's where a big part of the country is. It's the pissed off Tories who didn't turn up. It's a lot of Labour red wall voters who can't believe that having switched to the Tories then let immigration, you know, go up even more, even though we'd left the European Union. There's a whole fertile area of people there. The kind of people who traditionally watch the BBC, but in recent years they've got a bit pissed off with the BBC because it talks down to them. The kind of people who run small businesses. The kind of people who, you know, do self-assessment tax returns and are really concerned about the size of the tax burden. The kind of people running, you know, retail and want some really punchy policies to lower business rates, to make business easier to do. And it's not just small business owners. Two-thirds of the people in this country are employed by small businesses, right? Small businesses are over half our GDP. Most journalists and politicians think business is the CBI, right? And the Institute of Directors. No, most businesses are family-owned businesses, small businesses, ordinary people doing extraordinary things to make payroll, and the people who work for them, who are often close friends with the relationships that go back a long way, sometimes even generations. These are the people, and it is a hackneyed phrase, the kind of silent majority. Britain is basically a small Tennessee conservative country. It just is. It just is. I say that as a newcomer, relatively, to this country. I have no cultural or genealogical affinity with any of the tribes at all. But Britain is broadly small C conservative. And if that means the centre ground, they should fight on the centre ground. But the centre ground that politicos talk about now is not the centre ground. It's their centre ground. It's the centre ground of their life and all their posh university friends and all their dinner parties. Because journalism itself and politics itself has become so unrepresentative of ordinary people. You know, when I first went into as a parliamentary journalist, it was the very fag end of when you had people who had been miners, teachers, company bosses, you know, coming into parliament later in life, once they'd actually done something. Brilliant, broadly representative of real people. Now parliament's full of, you know, hacks and ex-trade union officials and people who are spads, frankly, special advisors, professional politicos rather than ordinary people. And it's the same with journalism. We've talked about it in the past. Journalism is incredibly difficult and unattractive when you get into it. If you're from a regular background, you haven't got a house in London, you know, mummy and daddy can't make phone calls for you and pay your council tax, you know. For ordinary people to get into journalism now is really, really tough. The regional papers are destroyed. Google and Facebook have taken a load of the money, hollowed out the newspaper model. And we're all trying to, in our different ways, Brendan, trying to make that model work. But the point is, politics and the media is woefully unrepresentative of ordinary people. And I say that as a very politically engaged person who is obviously in the media. The center ground, according to our political media class, is not the real center ground. The real center ground where the Tories need to fight, the center ground out there in the country, is quite a long way to the right of that perceived center ground. Starmer's support is very fragile, very brittle. He's got a big majority, but his party, yeah, a lot of people in his party, they're not in there to be in government. They're there to oppose because that's what they temperamentally do. And we need people like that in politics. But I think the Tories need to understand that the real battlefield for this election is on the centre right. And I think they should go with a candidate from that conservative tradition at this point. I think their party needs it. And I think the country desperately needs it.
Yeah. And if you look at people who call themselves centrists, you know, the people who pose as being the occupiers of the centre ground, you know, these are the people who think women can have penises, or that, you know, the vote for Brexit should have been blocked, or that immigration should be, you know, as wide open as possible.
Each of those positions is incredibly extreme, by the way.
Yeah. To most people out there, that's not centrist at all. That's extremist. Absolutely right. Okay, Liam, my final question for you, and you've just touched on it there, actually, is about the media and the press. And you've described just now, and we've talked about it before, how much the media has changed. You know, at least in the old days, it was possible for people from pretty ordinary backgrounds to work their way up from through the local papers, the local presses, to get into the national papers, perhaps the national media. Lots of those avenues have been closed off. And as one of the consequences of that is that the media does sometimes feel a bit like a club for people from certain sections of society and increasingly unrepresentative, which makes it all the more important, I think, to have other media outlets that say different things or represent different interests. That's what we want to do at Spike. That's what we've been doing for quite a long time now. And there are other outlets as well that try to do something similar. And so I wanted to ask you on that front. I did want to ask you, not because I want to end on a bum note, but I did want to ask you about the GB News, the future of GB News. But beyond that, just the future of
GB
News. So some listeners will know that you were the economics and business editor at GB News. I think they got you in 2021. You presented a show and you were on numerous shows there, and you were basically their economics guy. And then you left in June this year, quite suddenly. I think people were quite surprised by that. So I did want to ask you what the story is there, what you think the future of GB News might be, and what that might tell us about the future of alternative media in the sense of a new media that might hold the establishment to account a bit more.
Well, Brendan, there's a lot I could say about GB News, and a lot of people ask me to talk about GB News, and I will at some stage. But what I'd like to say for now, the first thing I'd like to say are the good things about GB News. GB News, for all the sniping and carping, was and is a major development in the history of the media industry in this country. And our media industry is one of the most important in the world, not just because of its absolute size, but because of the historic role of the British media. The whole world is watching our media landscape, which is one of the roughest and toughest and most competitive media landscapes out there. So I think it's great that GB News launched per se. It'd be nice if some other well-upholstered broadcasters sitting in a jacuzzi of state cash felt the same thing, but they obviously don't. It's absolutely amazing what GB News has done to replenish the gene pool of people in British television news. I could name you, Brendan, literally dozens and dozens of young people who got jobs at GB News, often from the regions, often they'd been working on a local free paper, hardly working in journalism at all. People, and I know, Brendan, would not get a look in at places I've worked, BBC, Channel 4, ITN. They would not get a look in, partly because they might be a bit rough around the edges. They didn't have that polished CV. But by God, did some really good young people turn up at GB News. And by God, they were fantastic. Putting up with crap piled on them from so-called big beast superannuated broadcasters, slagging them off all the time. They were just there round the clock making a brand new TV channel work. And a lot of those snidey comments from established media towards GB News, it hasn't stopped them poaching a lot of really good young people that GB News trained. And good for those young people, because they have now got their start in big league TV news and the media in general. And they won't be gainsaid. They won't be told they're not good enough anymore because they've proved themselves. I saw really bright people turn up at GB News, and within months, they were outputting their own shows. What does that mean? It means you are basically, along with the presenter, and these were people in my ear, holding up the channel, right? You are deciding where you go next. That satellite doesn't work. Where do we go to? You got 5 seconds to decide. I mean, television news is an insane industry. It's a drug. I'm an addict, right? It was great to be part of it. But what I've seen is a load of really smart young people come through GB News, move on to the more established broadcasters, and good for them, because they are now in the gene pool of British television news. They can have media careers for the rest of their lives if they want, because of the experience that GB News gave them. And that is an unequivocally good thing that wouldn't have happened without GB News. The second thing I'd say is that it's great to be part of a team and to build something. You know, I've been involved with quite a lot of startups over the years. And in the early months of GB News, it was absolutely electrifying. And the more we were slagged off by the great and the good, the more we knew we were onto something, and the more, you know, frankly, fun it was. And for a sort of grey beard like me, it was just great to be around so many really smart young people. And there are other very established broadcasters I could name. I won't name them. Viewers know. Really big beasts who are at GB News for a while. And we all feel the same way. It was so great to be part of a startup and to help replenish the gene pool of British TV news, because it's been a very narrow gene pool, increasingly so over recent years. The trouble for me, and I was made redundant from GB News, right? I didn't choose to go. I was made redundant from GB News. The issue for me is that in the end, even though I remain completely professional and I worked very, very hard and I was extremely productive, I could go on any show at any time at the drop of a hat and talk pretty coherently about an economic issue of the day or two. And that kind of became my job, sort of filling in where the channel was about to fall off air sometimes. You know, ask some of the producers, is Liam here? We'll be okay. Is he in the building? We'll be okay. Because they could just put me on air and I could talk about politics or economics. Not off the top of my head, because obviously I write about this stuff all the time, but that was kind of my role. And it was quite enjoyable to be that kind of mad fireman, slightly demeaning if you wanted to be pompous about it. Shouldn't my journalism stand on its own? But anyway, so I was there working very hard, but basically I stood for and stand for a version of GB News, which I would call the Telegraph on the telly, right? Because the real gap in the market is just to the right of the Today programme. These kind of disillusioned swing voters, many of them Conservatives, but quite a lot of them not, quite a lot of them traditional Labour voters, particularly out of London, who are dismayed. I know, because I have thousands of emails from them, Brendan, and posts on social media. They're dismayed by television news. They think Sky, ITV, Channel 4 News, BBC doesn't speak to them. It thinks it patronises them. You know, they understand that just because you've got, you know, rightly, a few more brown and female faces on the screen, that doesn't mean diversity, because cognitive diversity has diminished over recent years. As the screens have looked more diverse, I think they've become far less diverse in terms of diversity of opinion, which in a democracy is by far the most important form of diversity, or at least it should be. So I want to kind of telegraph on the telly GB News. I still think that's where the market is. I still think that's commercially viable. I want GB News to become commercially viable and not just at the behest and whim of a group of wealthy individuals for whom the media might in some cases be a side interest, not in all cases. GB News needs to exist in this country, or something like GB News needs to exist, which is why I'm having been asked by people I massively respect, like Andrew Neil and various other very senior people I'd worked with in television news at the BBC, at ITN, etc. A lot of us went there because we believed that we needed something to provide trusted news for people outside London, for people upset, rightly upset, with the kind of tunnel that mainstream economic and business and indeed political television news had gone down. But what we've ended up with at GB News isn't a vision that I think is going to work. I don't think it's economically viable. If I was an investor, and I've been an asset manager at a pretty senior level, I wouldn't invest in it because I don't think there is enough of a market for a kind of Fox News UK. I don't think the market's big enough. I don't think the advertising you could get off that audience is commercially attractive enough. And I don't actually think it's good for the country to have siloed news as they do in America, as they do to a lesser extent, but they still do in Australia. Look, I spent a lot of my life in Australia. I spent a lot of my life in America, maybe like you, Brendan, Irish exiles that we are. I have very dear family in both those countries. I know both those countries very, very well. And of course, we share a common language. But there are such huge cultural and political and commercial differences between the US and Australia on the one hand and the UK on another. I don't think Fox News in the UK is going to work. I don't think it's a good idea to have so many spats with Ofcom, however reactionary, however unfair you think Ofcom may be. I happen to think that the Ofcom rules are pretty, for the most part, for now at least, Labour may change this. You know, as a broadcaster, I know where the line is with Ofcom and I toe that line. What's the point in being Ofcom'd all the time? It's just going to mean your advertisers never come. So I'm not going to get into the personalities, though I could. I absolutely could. I absolutely could get into the personalities. And maybe one day I will. But I like to think I'm too much of a pro for that. We'll see. But where I do have a very legitimate point of view, and a lot of investors agree with me, by the way, is that I think if there is a gap in the television news market in the UK, it's a centre-right gap. It's not a Fox News UK gap. And in the end, I was a big beast in the newsroom with a lot of loyalty among people in the newsroom, among the sort of producers and so on. And I stood for a different vision of GB News. And so I guess that's why they chopped my head off.
Liam, on that note, thank you very much. Thank you for listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. We'll be back with another guest and more discussion. Don't forget to subscribe. And in the meantime, keep reading Spiked at www.spiked-online.com.